Thank you, Doug, for most of those statements. Appreciate it, and good to be with you in Denton, Texas. First became acquainted with the Pearl Street congregation more than 20 years ago, I guess, when I came here to attend the Warren flu debate. And they had day sessions here in the building, and we enjoyed so much that week and came back later on and had a part in supporting financially the debate that was held later on with Barnhart here on the ethics question. And then during between those two debates in Florida, this congregation where I was working at that time had the oversight of the Warren Mattson debate. So I've known about the Denton work for many years and have appreciated with a great deal of interest the lectureship each year. And I recall a few years ago when they decided to publish the lectures that were given each year at the School of Preaching lectureship in Florida, that one of the things that I said, as long as I don't have to do anything on the editing of it, I'll be glad to have the book done. Brother Bob and some of them said, well, we'll take care of the editing of it and see that it gets published. You select the speakers and the board of directors approve that and the topics and turn that in and we'll edit the book. I said, wonderful. And one of the things that they used as a guideline was the lectureship book here as a model and wanted to try to put out somewhat the same kind of material that you're doing. I'd like to say just a word about the significance of such lectureships as yours, and what we try to do in the lectureship, and I'm sure the other schools of preaching do as well, is make the lectureship an extension of our classroom work so that the men who are in training can have access to men who have studied a particular subject and researched it and presented, and they get the variety that they would not get on a daily basis, and thus extension of what they're trying to receive as training. Brotherhood-wise, I don't know that we could put a emphasis that would be high enough upon such lectureships as the one that you've had over the years. When we were fighting the Crossroads Movement, at that time it was called that, later it became the Boston Movement, International Church of Christ Now. I remember a news reporter who was, she's editor of the St. Petersburg Times religious section that came out each Saturday. And there was heated controversy in the state of Florida over the Crossroads element and the Crossroads Movement. She called me for an interview because she had seen my name and the church's name where I was working in opposition to it and some other churches that were favoring it. And I tried to put it into focus for her by saying that we have no central headquarters. She was a Roman Catholic by religion and thus would not understand what was involved. And I said, you have to understand that what we're involved in is a big family fuss. And in these fusses, we make up our mind which way we're going. And we study these things and we argue about these things, and then those who want to do what's right choose one direction, and those who want to go the other direction go the other way. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 19, Paul says, there must be divisions among you. Must be. Not that there may be. That the ones which are genuine might be made known. Any fuss that we have, any fight, any battle that we have will be seen and understood, and we'll know where people are as they line up on take sides. David Brown and I were talking last night, yesterday afternoon, I guess it was sometime, as we were between speeches here, and he was talking about when history reveals or records what's going on now and people look back on it, contending for the faith will have played a significant role, and I agreed wholeheartedly. But the Denton Church will also have played a tremendous role. If you wanted to know what was taking place in our brotherhood, in our family fusses, in our difficulties that we have in the church, if you buy the lectureship books of the Denton lectures each year, you'll have a tremendous insight into what the problems were and also solutions to. And so a significant significance ought to be attached to this lectureship, and I appreciate being asked to be a part of it, and I commend you for doing it. And all the ones who work so diligently, I know it's not easy to put out something like this, and the people who work behind the scenes getting us to and from locations and all that goes with it, the people who uphold the hands of Doug and his cohorts in the congregation here need to be commended. But I don't want to reminisce too far because I won't have any time to do what I was assigned to do. Difficult text. When you think about difficulties, sometimes the difficulties are not apparent to the person who hasn't studied all the ramifications involved. And so sometimes you have to show what the difficulty is before you can ever help the people to see. And thus, I think that's the case with our opening statement here in verse 15 of Ephesians chapter 3. Now, I'm going to be emphasizing from studying from the standpoint that here are some difficulties. And as you look at these difficulties, what is the problem? What is the solution to it? Well, the difficulty comes in Ephesians 3:15. As you read the American Standard Translation or the King James, the wording is not exactly the same. The King James, for example, has, "of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named." And not a great deal of difficulty with that if you look at that statement and take it in its context. But then when you look at the American Standard, you have, "from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named." So to begin with, we have a problem with the translation. And then when you look at the translation, then the interpretation. The Greek is still the same. And so when you look at the problem that is created and then the solutions sometimes that are offered, what does it mean when God says, the Bible says, every family in heaven and earth is named? Does God give a name to every particular individual family on earth? Some would suggest that because God is the Father of all things, and He set up fathers and families to give names to families. And as a result of that, and so that is one solution, but when we look at that from the standpoint of the families in heaven, what are you going to have? Are angelic beings grouped under family? Well, if it is, it's certainly not in the same sense that we're under families because they neither marry nor are given in marriage. There's not family units there. And so that creates a problem. And that's, I suppose, what I was supposed to reflect upon. What is the solution? Well, you could weigh commentaries and ask individuals and have opinions tossed back and forth, but eventually you'll have to go back to the text itself in the original language. There's where the solution will be. And the key to it is the fact that here in this verse, there is not the definite article in Greek before the word whole or every. And sometimes the American Standard, I think, is too literalizing here and not paying enough attention to the context. I quoted a Greek source and cited others in there to sustain what I'm going to say here, and that is that when you have the definite article in Greek, there is a certain definiteness associated with that. But if there is not the definite article, it may or it may not be definite. Now, what does all that mean? It means, is he saying, the whole. We put in English, the King James does, the whole family in heaven and earth is named after God. That's having to do with His redeemed people. Well, the American Standard is leaving off the article and saying since it doesn't have the article, it is not definite, it's just general. That means every family in a general sense. Well, how do you ever decide? You see, in the text there, we noted that it may or it may not be. You go to the context. There's really the most important thing in understanding any text of the Bible or any other statement, not just in the Bible, is context. What does the word rib mean, R-I-B? Well, everybody knows they got some. No, you don't know what I'm talking about until I use that word in a sentence. My boys used to have spelling assignments when they were in elementary school, very early in their education, and they'd call and ask me, "Dad, what does this word mean?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I got to use it in a sentence." And so the teacher would give them a spelling word and ask them to use it in a sentence so that that would fix that meaning in their mind. But if I don't hear it in a sentence, I don't know what you mean by rib. See, I'm an ex-coal miner, and the walls of the coal mines was called the rib. Well, if that wasn't in the context of coal mining, not in your darkest imagination, would you understand what rib meant? The rib meant the side of the coal that was left. Well, words have context. What does the word shoe mean? Well, you don't know until somebody uses it. You take any word you want. You look in a dictionary, they've got all kinds. Well, what does the word mean? Depends on the context. And that's true in this word. Well, what is the context here in this passage? In Ephesians 3 and verse 15, is God distributing, is he talking about families in general and distributing them under heads? Or is it the case that he's bringing together all that belong to him under one and saying that they occupy or have the name of God, both in heaven and on earth? And God has an obligation because of that, and we have a wonderful privilege to be called his children. And thus, the whole family in heaven and earth. Look at this family of God in Revelation chapter 7. In Revelation chapter 7, you've got two pictures of God's people, one on earth and one in heaven. The ones on earth are seen as the 144,000 who are sealed of God. And then he turns in verse 9 of chapter 7, and he sees a great throne of people in heaven. No man could number from every tribe, nation, people. And then he goes on to say, who are these? The angel asks John. He says, thou knowest. And the angel is given, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation. And they've made themselves right, you see, in the blood of the Lamb. Well, here's the whole family of God under two pictures. Number one, the sealed of God on earth. Number two, those around the throne of God who have come out of this great trouble that John and others are in. And so here's the family of God, I think, pictured here in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 15. Problem is not in the King James, it doesn't lend. I think the King James is a superior reference here to that. It should be the whole family of God and not every family, and that would solve that problem. So context again. When you look at the context, what does that word mean? Well, it demands the article here, the whole family, as the King James put it in. And it's not an incorrect rendering of it. Well, the next verses I've been assigned to look at as far as problems are concerned is chapter 3 of Ephesians and verse 16 and 20. And these verses have to do with some problems about how are we strengthened by the Holy Spirit working in us. And what is that power that is working within us? Well, I think one of those almost answers the other. But there are some thoughts that need to be presented, I believe, to help us here. Let me read, first of all, Ephesians 3:16. That he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might by his Spirit in the inner man. I suggested in the notes, as you read the chapter in there, that we ought to have an understanding of what the inner man is. And here is the inner man that is a significant part. God strengthens the inner man. Here's another verse. In verse 20 reads, now to him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh in us. Well, here is God doing something. And it is involving us to the point of being strengthened. Well, I offer another suggestion here, a passage that might give us some help in seeing the difficulty that may come to a person. In Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12, Paul says, not only in my absence are you doing this, or in my presence were you doing this, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. But then verse 13 has an interesting statement here related somewhat to the problem that comes in the passage I've been assigned to look at. And verse 13 reads, for it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Well, now I've got to look at some things here to understand what is my responsibility. And how does God relate to that in making me what I need to be, strengthening me? And how is it that God works in me both to will and to do what he pleases? I know we've had a lot said about Calvinism this week, and rightly so, because these things are bordering on that kind of misunderstanding if we're not careful. We need to have some basic ideas that will guide us through any kind of a problem, I'm convinced. I think two areas here that we need to really study deeply. And that is the nature of God and the nature of man. Is it not the case that most problems, real serious problems, come up in religious matters when we misunderstand the nature of God? are the nature of man. And to understand each one of these is to help us to avoid some pitfalls that some might get themselves into if they don't carefully study this. Well, one of these I want to emphasize here now is the principle that man is a free moral agent. Now, I need to drive that peg down, and I need to anchor some things around that and never move away from that. I know that from explicit statements and implicit statements. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Man has the freedom to go to God or not. Jesus said to the Jewish nations, how often I would have gathered you myself as a hen gathereth her chicks, but ye would not. Notice that. Here is God trying to work with man, but man refuses. Jeremiah was told to go down to visit the potter and to look at the potter as he worked on the wheel. And he said to Jeremiah, Jeremiah, cannot I do with nations what that potter does with the clay? Now, can I not do, if I can do that with nations, I can do that with Israel. Another insight, I think, comes from the study of the prophets like Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 18, God demands that man get himself, make in himself a new heart. But in Ezekiel chapter 36, God says, I'm going to put a new heart in Israel. I'm going to take away that heart of stone and rebellion and disobedience, and I'm going to put a fleshly heart in there. Well, here's God at work, isn't he? God's going to do some things, but I've got some responsibility. How does my free will and God's overriding ruling in the affairs of man work out? Well, I've got to hold on to two basic things. Number one, the freedom of man and how God operates and acts in conjunction with that freedom. And so here I think we have some guidelines in solving some problems. If I hold on to the freedom of man, free will of man, I'm not going to make some mistakes over here that's going to say that God now is in control and God's really doing this. As Flip Wilson, the black comic a few years ago, the devil made him do it, you know. Well, a lot of people, I think, blame the devil for some things that they were responsible for. And I think they've said God caused me to do some things when God hadn't done it. We can blame things on God when God's not behind it. And so it is, I think, with us. Here's an interesting passage in Psalms. Psalm 119, verse 98 and 99. And here we have the idea of strengthening and power being associated with the man of God, child of God. And the passage reads, Thou, through thy commandments, has made me wiser than mine enemies, for they are ever with me. Now, God wills and desires that I be wiser than my enemies. And God wills and desires and will work in me to make that possible. And one of the avenues here that he says is because that word is resonant and I hold on to it in all circumstances. Look at the next verse. I have more understanding than all my teachers. Why? For thy testimonies are my meditation. Well, I can look back on some men that I had as teachers. And while I respected them and was submissive to them in their classes, but I know some things that they don't know. And I am smarter in some things than they are because my convictions and my dedication is to what God said. Not because of my genius, but because of God's genius. And it's simply up to me to find out what God says and to be consistent with it. If it will, there is no truth on the side of the enemy. Not one. And the best way to answer an enemy's attack is to take the passage that he's going to twist and pervert. And when I know what God said and how he said it, then I have disarmed the enemy. And I'm smarter than him, not because of my IQ, but because of God's P&Q. Now, I think when we look at that with our freedom and those things, it ought to help us, my free will and God's will and determination. There is a passage I'd like to do a little technical work here that's not in the manuscript, but I told Doug I wanted to use it, and he gave me permission to do it because I know he sent me a letter. Now, if you're not going to follow what you wrote, I don't want to have to get up here and pull you out of the pulpit. So he said I could do this one, all right? Look at Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 and 9. There's an interesting statement here by the Apostle Paul. And I'm indebted to Brother Woodson for calling this to my attention and some work that he did several years ago. But in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 8 and 9, we've heard this passage and read it, and I suppose I've had to answer some questions or objections and perversions of it. Notice it says that there is something here that is the gift of God, and that means our salvation is God's gift. Well, somebody wants to be salvation wholly of God then. No, it's not wholly of God. Here's salvation. It's not of anything that I could do to develop it or to make it. It's God's doing. God both to will and to make in me a saved person. Gift of God, salvation is. But now look at verse 8. For by grace have you been saved through faith, that not of yourself, it is the gift of God, not of works, no man should glory. For we are his workmanship. We're something God's made. Created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God afore prepared that we should walk in them. Do you see God working in that? But you've also got to see my free will working in that. God's wanting to work with me as he did with Israel, but Israel would not. I would, but you would not. My free will. And God is so particular in this that he will not change and destroy my free will. But now the technical part comes in this, you have been saved, verse 8. If you use the King James Version, you'll see it is, you are saved. Wonder what is the meaning of that? There is a technical principle here in the Greek that's called a periphrastic, which means it uses two tenses to get across an idea that is very difficult in English to get across in one English expression. King James opted out for the you are saved, present tense. Well, there is a present tense verb, and there is a perfect tense, which has to do with action that had a coming into being, a completion, and an action that continues. The perfect tense can be seen in Jesus' statement in the temptation. When the devil tempted him, he says, it is written, or it stands written. Something was written by God in the past. It had a beginning, it had completion, and it stood in the present tense. It still stood. It stands written. Thou shalt not live but bread alone. Every word that proceeds from the mouth. That's a perfect tense. Well, here you have the present tense. You are saved. You have come through a process of salvation and you remain saved. Now then, point is that right here, inseparably connected, is how God is working both with me before I became a child of God and how I stay a child of God. How so? It is by grace through faith. If I understand how my freedom and God's grace and how he worked in me to make me a child of God and to help me be his child, then I also have by that same process an understanding of how grace through faith works in keeping me his child. You see, if we have here salvation as a circle, whatever gets me into that circle is grace through faith. But by these two tenses, have been saved and are saved, present tense, that keeps me there. And it's a gift of God, God working to help me. And so I think there is a serious danger when a person moves over to the fact that they have God doing something that is different after they become a child of God than before. God at work in it? Absolutely. But God is working in it in conjunction with my freedom. And I can always say no to God. But God is able to do abundantly above all that you're able to ask or to think. Just stop and think about that. God at work. You ever study the life of Joseph? Sold by his brother. Becoming a slave in Egypt. God at work in that? Absolutely. Joseph have anything to do with it? Yes. He was faithful and loyal. He remember he had some dreams back there. And those dreams sustained him when he's down there in Egypt because he had been told in a dream that some way, somehow, somewhere, his father and brethren would bow down to him. I don't know how it's all going to work out. God's going to have to work it out. But you know the story. At the end of all that process, as he looked back on it, he said to his brothers who were afraid of him, "Now you intended it for harm. I know what you did." God has enabled whole people to be saved alive this day. Well, Joseph, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You've got some rough roads to go. But God is going. Romans 8:28. All things work together for good. You know, Pentecostalism and these people who have to have a special person to pray for them have lost sight of the marvelous providence of God. God is able to do abundantly beyond what you're able to even think. In other words, you don't even know what the best solution is. You remember the book of Habakkuk? Habakkuk had prayed and prayed and prayed, "God, how long am I going to have to cry and beg and plead and nothing happen?" God says to Habakkuk, "If I told you what I'm doing, Habakkuk, you wouldn't believe it. I'm about ready to move Babylon over here to remove this stubborn, disobedient, rebellious people." Habakkuk said, "Oh, wait a minute, God. You're holy. I know your nature, I understand you, and you're too holy to be involved with. Well, I know we're bad, but we're not bad as Babylon." Yeah. That doesn't mean Babylon is not going to one day to get what she deserves, but right now, God says, "I'm working." You see, Habakkuk had a problem understanding. Job had a problem understanding how it was that God could work in this world to make things good out of something that's bad. I've got to have a great faith in God. When I go through these valleys of depression and difficulty and heartache and pain, my faith has to sustain me. I've got to remember God is able to work in ways far beyond my imagination. I know a man, know him intimately well. He sat outside of a judge's quarters on one occasion, and the only prayer that he could utter was the prayer that Abraham took to God relative to Sodom. When he knew he had relatives in Sodom, and God had said, "Enough is enough, and I'm going to destroy that wicked city." And Abraham took his petitions to God based upon knowing the nature of God, and the nature of God is simply this: will the God of all the earth do right? And that man prayed that prayer. If God would do right for Abraham, would he do right for his children? God is able to use judges and courts, civil leaders, elders of the church, faithful Christian people, to do for us more than we could ever imagine. God's at work. And in all the activities that surround me, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, no temptation taken me but such as is common man. All of us have the same kind of problem. You've got family problems, you've got difficulties, you've got heartache and pain and disappointment and joy. And God is not going to put more on us than we are able. But God's working. He's not finished with me yet. He's not finished with you. And he's long-suffering. Aren't you glad? Don't want any of us to perish. But he's fitting us for something far beyond this world. And so when we think of what God is doing here to strengthen, yes, he strengthens, but he also puts problems out there. He permits problems to be in the way. And we count it all joy when we're able to pass those difficulties and tasks, are we not? James chapter 1. Count it all joy. Being faithful to God could lift up their voices and sing in prison because they've been counted worthy to suffer. But my, what men it was molding and making. Oh, God is able to use all these things, all of these things, to mold me and to take the edges off and to refine me as a potter does the clay. Our God is able, and he will, and we thank God for it. So the problem is not so much something that we can absolutely exhaust, but we can say with Habakkuk, when he saw what God was going to do, and God says to him, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Our God can move in all these areas. And when I take him these things to him in prayer, Revelation chapter 8, in a vivid picture presentation of God's power, when those throngs, when those prayers of the saints, mingled with the incense from that altar, ascend unto God, there is an earthquake and lightning and thunders, and this old world is shaken. All those prayers are heard. And we need to understand that and to appreciate it. And I hope that these thoughts might help us to do that. If divine power was not given to the Christ when he was tempted, and if he is in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, if possible, let this cup pass from me. All of these things are natural situations that he had to deal with. God is not going to give more to us, but he will give the same kind of power. What does it mean to be filled with all the fullness of God? The fullness of God there, I believe, has to do with all that God has designed and intended and purposed and planned for his children in the church. And God is filling us with all blessing. Do you ever stop and think about being filled with forgiveness and fellowship? God is doing these things in order to make us what we need to be and to realize that we're not missing anything. Some people get dissatisfied as Christians and thinking that they've lost out on something. Pentecostal people chide you with the fact, oh, you're just cold, and no, you don't know what you're talking about. Look what you're missing. Spirit-filled. No, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what spirit-filled is. Now, I grew up in Kentucky. They called the people like that hola rollers, and they did that not out of a some of them did for sarcasm, but there was more reality to that than not. And today we see it coming back. The great Pentecostal churches in Lakeland, Florida, great in the sense by name, they've got what they call holy laughter. And they're doing the same thing that we're doing in the Pentecostal churches years ago. Women laying on the floor, wallowing around, rolling around. Spirit filled. No, that's not. Every bit of that is an act. I saw a tape on it, and they'd go by there, and when the camera would be turned on a man, they'd go in just as the camera would leave, they'd calm down. This old group over here, wherever they pointed the cameras, where the spirit hit. It's just, that's kind of foolish. That's kind of foolish. You see, that's taking these words and reading them with absolutely no appreciation, understanding for context, and what the truth is, no matter who's a child of God and not. One last point, captivity led captive. I think there is a need in understanding what is called typology. I've suggested some areas in the book that you can read and hopefully get some help from, but look at a couple of passages here and the lessons will be yours. In Matthew chapter 2, I think that we can see that there has to be an approach to understanding typology. You have a number of statements here in Matthew chapter 2 that call for an understanding of how the Bible talks about fulfilled prophecy. One of those is in verse 15 of Matthew 2, and that is, out of Egypt I have called my son. Well, Israel of old, as a nation of people, were called out of Egypt as God's son, but they only typified a far greater event that was yet to be. And thus, when Jesus came up out of Egypt, there is an absolute fulfillment of what God had typified with his people there. Another passage in the same, with Rachel weeping for her children and will not be comforted, in this same Matthew chapter 2 passage. Well, how does that fit in? It fits in because there was a tremendous sorrow when Israel went into captivity. And when the children are killed here at the birth of Christ, there was another great event. That only typified in the past what is here. And the last one down here would be in verse 23, where Jesus was called a Nazarene as it was spoken through the prophets, plural. Well, Nazareth was a place of contempt. Any good thing come out of Nazareth? No. Well, Jesus was looked upon with contempt in that. And so typology, I think, is the solution to understanding that problem. And I hope that what we've said in the book, I've enjoyed being here. The book will help you in understanding typology and not going to the extreme in it, because there are some guidelines and limitations that must be there. When we once understand that, out of captivity, here was Israel, you see, in the past, taken captive, and those who had her captive now had been thrown down. And thus, as the triumphant march was had, and God had worked in that, if you'll read that 68th Psalm, but a far greater captivity was there when man was in bondage to sin and sorrow and without hope. And God moves now to take away all that the devil has, us in his clutches. And there is captivity captured. And that was done when Christ ascended. Hopefully these things will help you.